The next talk is by Herbert. And he's going to talk on more or less the same topic of policies for emerging energy policy. And I'm quite sure that Telescope will be
Certainly is, yeah. So. Thank you. Well, in some ways, this should be called emerging energy and climate policy. And it's very, very interesting to hear a practitioner speak about the daily work that you're doing, because you know, this is really what it's all about, to make implementation happen and to find the practical ways in which to do it. And it was very, very fascinating to hear you talk from the coalface, as it were, of this work. I'm talking more of, as an observer and somebody who's trying to understand how energy use is affecting the global situation. And first, like, and the starting point of my presentation is the concept of energy slaves. Now, this is something that came out of research in Germany and elsewhere, and basically it quantifies the number of individuals like someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger at his prime, working for us on a daily basis in the form of machines and motors, and producing the equivalent of about 100 watts of electricity through that process on a daily basis. And the reality is that in Europe today, we have about 60 energy slaves working for us, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. In America, the figure is nearly twice as high. And in India, I expect at the present time something like 20 energy slaves, maybe 25 or that sort of figure. Of course, going up on an annual basis because of the increased development, economic urban development that is taking place here. So, and at this kind of level of energy use, particularly if it's based on fossil fuels, of course, is an astonishingly unsustainable state of affairs. Next slide, please. And one fundamental point that I think has to be made in this context is that economists basically start by saying the financial and manufacturing capital are at the heart of things. Whereas I think the reality of the situation is, unless we start with understanding how we fit into the natural systems, how we can assure that the continuity of nature is guaranteed through our ways of being and through our ways of acting, we will ultimately rush into the abyss. And there was a fascinating discussion at the World Bank some years ago between Herman Daly and another economist called Larry Summers. And Larry Summers said, manufacturing of financial capital comes first. And Herman Daly said, no, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the ecology, not the other way around. And Herman Daly was sacked as a result of this attitude, and so he's no longer working for the World Bank. So this certainly applies to energy systems just as much as the general way in which we deal with nature. So, I mean, one astonishing fact at the present time is we are burning in the region of about 2 million years worth of fossil fuels every year. That is, it took about 300 million years for oil and coal and gas to accumulate in the Earth crust. And we're burning at the rate of 2 million years a year, which is an absolutely astonishing state of affairs. And so the depletion of fossil fuel source, as well as the transfer of carbon to the atmosphere, is the absolutely critical issue. And how do we need to link that to energy and climate policy is really the critical issue, in my view, for humanity at this moment in time. So that means looking for future-proof global energy system, and that, of course, links directly to what we've heard a moment ago, how we can transfer the technology that we've taken for granted since the start of the Industrial Revolution to renewables in the way that we've just heard about. So how can we decarbonize economic and urban development? And how can pressure from civil society on policymakers drive that change? And that is the critical issue, because more often than not, consumers are so stuck, as much as policymakers, as much as practitioners in the electricity and in Germany in the energy system, in the current state of affairs, that consumer pressure is not nearly as great as it used to be. And that was very, very apparent just now when I was at the Rio conference 2 months ago, where certainly policymakers did not see the need for change to anything like the degree that is now necessary. Civil society was certainly trying hard, but clearly not hard enough. And by the way, we need much more access to the media for these changes that we need. Now, this is a movement that started in America, where, of course, This relates to the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is nearly 400 parts per million at the present time. And if current trends continue, we'll go up to 500 or 600 or more parts per million, which of course spells disaster for global temperatures. So there's a major movement starting in America by somebody called Bill McKibben on bringing down CO2 concentrations from 400 parts per million. Now, we already heard this morning about the critical need for energy efficiency and what that means for architecture, what that means for personal behavior patterns. And you referred very eloquently about how that relates to daily decision making and how that then relates to the changes in energy consumption patterns that take place. But on the one hand, you know, it's decisions at the personal level, at the private household level that are important. But on the other hand, without significant policy changes, these initiatives will not really be large scale enough, as large scale as they need to be to make global changes take place. So obviously, measuring energy performance of our building, as you heard in Lily's presentation this morning, is of critical importance and how that translates into changes in regulations for architecture. So these are critical issues and are beginning to happen all over the world. Next slide, please. So obviously, the question of investing in efficiency, we've already heard about in some detail, but the concept that is rather elegant. That came from Amory Roberts in America about 20 years ago. It's not to invest in megawatts, but to invest in megawatts. In other words, the need to avoid increased generating capacity in the first place. And this was first practiced in California in the 1970s under Jerry Brown. And the kind of trick that was used to create an incentive for the utilities to encourage consumers to consume less rather than consume more was to allow them to charge slightly more for a unit of electricity if they encourage consumers to make energy savings. Now, that's an important financial incentive, and I think certainly on the thought, and you've been discussing that in some detail in Tamil Nadu as well. Next slide, please. So certainly we are seeing a lot of work on improving energy efficiency standards in America, LEED in Britain, BREEAM, we've heard this morning about GREENER in India. So these are all important steps, but they are typically not mandatory. They're still largely voluntary. We are seeing now in Europe, targets for energy efficiency in building in Britain and Germany that are becoming mandatory. So passive house standards are likely to be kind of not the norm within sort of 4 or 5 years in new build across Europe. But even that possibly is not enough, ultimately, to make the real changes in terms of reducing our energy slaves that are working for us on a daily basis. There's a new concept out in Britain, which is not passive house, but active house standards, which is basically the house that is not only reduced energy consumption, but also becomes a net producer of electricity through solar and other built-in technology means. In terms of policy, not necessarily national government policy, but in terms of regional or local city policy, we're seeing interesting ways forward through energy performance contracting, which is basically a way that if a house, an existing building is to be retrofitted, the company that retrofits will be able to receive the current amount that's paid for electricity for a number of years after the conversion has taken place, so that the consumer of electricity will be paying the same price for maybe 5 to 10 years from now until the bill is fully paid off of retrofitting the building. And that is now being done, and then the price for the consumer goes down dramatically. So that is now being done in many cities across Europe, also increasingly in the United States. And it's a very neat policy to make retrofitting existing and energy inefficient buildings cost effective. In Switzerland, there's a very interesting initiative called the 2000 Watt Society. Typically, the consumption of energy per person is about 6,000 watts in the current time, and which roughly corresponds to about 60 energy slaves. How to encourage a reduction in that energy use to a third of that is being driven forward by cities like Zurich and Basel as a way of encouraging much more efficient use of energy. And that again links to performance contracting and practical ways by which energy efficiency standards and consumption patterns are raised. Again, we've heard quite a bit already about smart grids, which means, of course, better management of energy demand to reduce need for energy supply. And that, of course, is becoming very sophisticated. For instance, in Germany, they are now talking about ways of switching off the fridges or the freezers in people's houses via the internet when demand has to go down because renewable energy supplies are going, you know, less than they're supposed to be, so that you can have demand management long, you know, over distance via the internet in ways that, you know, the freezer being, or the fridge being switched off for a few hours does not mean that your stuff is suddenly going to defrost, because obviously you have well-insulated freezers or fridges don't thaw within a few hours or so. So these are intricate ways in which to assure that better demand management is initiated. Next slide, please. The other interesting thing that is beginning to have is new insulation materials. Now, this is a material called aerogel, which is, you could typically have the same insulation effect of something like that's 5 centimeters compared to of aerogel compared to 30 centimeters of rock wool or so. And that is very exciting because it basically means it is much easier to begin to retrofit buildings from inside rather than having to put new insulation materials on the facade of buildings, which often not very viable. This is the kind of material that is used in aeroplanes or aerogels or vacuum insulation panels. They're still quite expensive, but certainly this is emerging technologies. So Mr. Van Meegen said I will be talking about feed-in tariffs, and of course we've had quite a few presentations or references to that topic earlier on already. And so obviously it's a really clever way in which to assure that renewable energy is accelerated in a dramatic way. So it's a highly effective policy mechanism that lowers the barriers to the rapid development of renewable energy. Basically, as you may all know, I don't know how much you are involved in that discussion about feed-in tariffs, but it basically means that whoever produces renewable electricity from solar or wind or whatever technology is available to them can charge a higher price for that than from conventional power stations. So that is very much the summary of that policy. So there's basically, as it says here, differentiated prices are set for each different technology. Wind gets a lower price than solar because it's cheaper to produce wind-powered electricity. And it assures a good return on renewable energy investment. And the cost of introduction of renewable energy is shared by all energy consumers. In fact, it is not a mandated system where the government has to subsidize energy producers, but it is the consumer, the whole population, that shares the slightly increased cost of the electricity produced in that way. An increased demand for renewable energy has also led to dramatic technology innovation and therefore increased the production of solar or wind or other technologies. Next slide. Now, I already have this slide in my presentation this morning. It basically shows the really dramatic way in which this policy has transformed, in the process of transforming the energy system of one country. Now, this is an interesting story because it is partly driven by the fact that the Green Party in Germany is very prominent and has a very major role in parliament and has participated in governments, unlike in other countries in Europe where you don't have a voting system that allows Green parties to be dominant or, you know, strongly present in parliament. This is what drove this change under the government of Schröder in 2000. It started and it has these results, and I don't think I need to read it out in detail other than the fact that it's created a major new economy, that it has saved a significant amount of CO2 emissions, and that the total cost is only 6 euros per household per month, which is really not a very large figure given the fact that we've had such very considerable increase in the production of renewable electricity as a result. Next slide, please. So that also then led to new approaches to architecture, buildings, cloud-based solar panels, like this one here from a German company called Schüco, and they have basically shown that it is possible to cost-effectively clad buildings
with solar panels in this way, so the facade becomes a net producer of electricity. Next slide, please. Or, you know, this kind of new architecture that is suddenly popped up in different parts of Germany and elsewhere in Europe. Next slide, please. Or indeed, the first buildings that have become net exporters of electricity, like here in Freiburg in Germany. These buildings are also insulated with high efficiency panels, such as vacuum insulation panels, but they are basically power stations rather than power consumers. And certainly, if you can imagine cities beginning to take this kind of thing seriously, and we are, you know, for us to see urban development based on this type of architecture, it would certainly transform the energy performance of our cities. Next slide, please. And here's a fascinating look at the way in which the wind technology has been transformed partly or largely as a result of feed-in tariffs. In Denmark, just after California, after the United States, Denmark was the first country to adopt feed-in tariffs in the 1970s. And they started with 50 kilowatt machines, and now we are at 5 or even 6 or 7 megawatt per machine. Now, that some people may say that this is not a small, beautiful type of technology any longer, but rather too big and rather too prominent in the landscape. And there's certainly in Britain we have very much a sort of NIMBY, not in my backyard, response to large wind turbines of this kind. But nevertheless, I think it's transforming the energy scenarios of countries across Europe in a remarkable way. So once you have a series of 5 or 6 or 7 megawatt turbines, of course you're really seriously into producing large amounts of electricity. Next slide, please. And then there's discussions about how to produce not just electricity from wind power, but for instance, in offshore stations like this, how to create gas stations for tankers or for freighters going through the oceans, picking up on hydrogen that is produced by wind power in this way. Now, this is still a picture, you know, sort of hypothetical picture, but it's certainly feasible to think of a global ship transport relying on hydrogen rather than on diesel engines in power stations such as these, producing hydrogen offshore. So this is certainly no longer entirely pie in the sky. Next slide, please. So certainly we are now seeing feed-in tariffs popping up all over the world. About 60 countries around the world have feed-in tariffs, and many other regions of the world. For instance, in the United States, where it's not been possible to introduce a national feed-in tariff, individual cities, such as some cities in Florida and elsewhere, Gainesville in particular, but in Canada and Oregon and so on, have adopted and introduced their own regional or even local feed-in tariff. But of course, one pressure that has come from the power station and generator industry is they don't like decentralized energy production because it takes power away from them. So certainly in Germany, for instance, when they introduced feed-in tariffs, power station companies took the national government to court, all the way to the European Court in The Hague, to try and prevent that policy from being introduced. But in the end, the government won and the companies have lost, and we are now seeing the ever wider implication in implementation of renewable energy as a result. So similar developments are taking place now. I managed to introduce feed-in tariffs in South Australia, and talked earlier on this morning about how after 4 years, about every fifth building has a solar panel on it, which was an amazing development. We also managed to introduce feed-in tariffs in the UK too, but then very quickly, after the change of government from the Labour government to the current Conservative government, they reduced the feed-in price by less than 50%, by more than 50% in order to give power back to the big players, so that it's not a very helpful development. But these things are happening all over the place. You know, for a while it works well, and then suddenly there's major resistance and political support to the power station companies, then changes the situation back to a less desirable state of affairs. Next slide, please. So we already had, you know, quite a bit of talk this morning about smart grids, you know, that the critical importance of not just demand, supply management, but demand management. I don't think I have to go into much more detail than that. Except that I have to say that we've heard from you about energy storage, some pump storage systems, where there's many new systems being developed now for storing electricity, or indeed also for decentralizing energy supply. For instance, in Germany, as a result of what is now happening politically, which is that the Merkel government had been forced after Fukushima to give up on nuclear power stations, they're not now talking about, in addition to solar panels on people's roofs, also to introduce small-scale gas engines in people's cellars to produce additional electricity. And Volkswagen is now using Golf engines to help people do that. So instead of having big power stations, a few of them dotted across the country, you have thousands of mini power stations. You have virtually a democratization of power supply happening in Germany. So demand and supply management as very important twin initiatives. Next slide, please. So I already talked about Mazda this morning, national policy in Abu Dhabi leading to that kind of solar towns and development, and because I talked about this morning, I won't go into more detail. Next slide. In Tamil Nadu, of course, the important development of wind power, again, we've heard quite a bit about it, and it's really often held up as one of the great examples of wind power development. But we've heard from you that your words of caution about, how this has to be driven much further, and how wind power needs to really become much more mainstream in the policy context in Tamil Nadu. Interestingly, we are now seeing really significant policy-driven renewable energy development in North Africa. This is a picture of the largest solar power station currently under construction in Morocco, directly as a result of an initiative by the Moroccan government, but also with an eye, this is going to be 500 megawatt solar power station, so this is really quite something. But of course, the guaranteed presence of the sun there in the sky over Morocco all the time practically makes it a viable kind of investment. And again, you have both, the mirrors throwing the rays of the sun to the top of the tower, and then the energy being stored in part in salt so that the electricity can be produced even at night. This is really significant stuff that's happening. And also, I'm quite currently doing quite a bit of work in Saudi Arabia, and there too, major solar power stations are on the drawing board and likely to be implemented before long. Next slide, please. Partly with the view of, in Saudi Arabia in particular, this is a project called DesertTech, I'm sure you've read about it, where basically the idea is to, given the fact that it is quite hard for European countries to be fully self-sufficient in renewable energy, even with linkages to hydro power stations in places like Norway or to energy storage systems elsewhere in Scandinavia. The idea is to link Europe to North Africa and even to Saudi Arabia with DC current transmission lines. And in Saudi Arabia, they're saying, okay, we need most of the electricity in the summer months, but we are requiring much less electricity in the winter months, so why don't we then export through DC lines, and also by producing hydrogen from solar electricity, export that energy to Europe when the oil becomes less. You see a little dot there, it says world, the world energy supply could come from an area of desert, it says world 2005, just as small as that. But obviously there are technical problems, there's also concerns about the question of whether these are reliable forms of energy supply given the volatility of the political situation in the Middle East and so on. Nevertheless, it's being driven forward quite dramatically, particularly with solar power from places like Morocco, as I showed a moment ago, because the Moroccan government certainly has an eye on exporting some of that electricity rather than only using it at home. Next slide. Yeah, I think this is the final slide. Basically, going back to the start of my talk, which is to say that currently, we have this enormous energy consumption from fossil fuels, but we certainly need global policies now to, whilst we continue burning fossil fuels and whilst CO2 emissions are still continuing to go up in the atmosphere, to find better ways of absorbing CO2 emissions through biological means within vegetation, within forests, within soils. And there's a lot of work going on, including by an organization, by someone who gave a speech here last year, Peter Head, initiative called the Ecological Sequestration Trust, how we can store carbon dioxide in vegetation by biological means as part of a global policy scenario for humanity, not to outgrow the resources of the biosphere as we are currently doing. Thank you very much. I think that's the last slide. Can you just make sure it's the last slide? This is the last slide. This is from the cover of a report I wrote called Regenerative Cities, which basically says, in an urbanizing world, unless we find a balance between urban system and their resource demand and the natural world, we will simply outgrow the capacity of the planet to supply us. And so it's of critical importance in global policy terms to assure that this balance is really created by deliberate acts of government and international policy. Thank you very much. So the optimistic perspective is that, you know, we had waves of innovation starting with the Industrial Revolution in the late 80s, and 1800s, and we had steam power, then we had the third wave of electricity, chemicals, fourth wave of chemicals, electronics from 1950s onwards, then we had the digital revolution, biotechnology, software. And so the hope is that we are really taking sustainability, or as I would say, regenerative planning and policies and measures, as well as resource productivity, whole systems design, biomimicry, and all these things as our guiding principles for policy development in the years to come. I think that is the last slide, isn't it? Thank you.
Thanks a lot.